The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Buonasera and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Irene Malfatto and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Ross King, for several reasons. First, I am an antiquarian bookseller right here in Philadelphia and I specialize in manuscripts. Second, I'm from Italy and I earned my PhD in medieval literature in Florence, where the subject of tonight's book lived and worked. And third, I'm just plain enjoying Mr. King's book, and I'm thrilled to be here to introduce him. Needless to say, all of this is very much in my wheelhouse. Praised by Time magazine for his skill at elucidating crucial episodes in the history of art and architecture, Ross King is the author of many best-selling nonfiction books that peek behind the curtain of history into the studios, workshops, and inner toils and torments of some of the world's greatest artists. These works include Brunelleschi's Dome, Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, Leonardo and the Last Supper, and Mad Enchantment, a portrait of the struggles turning just beneath the tranquil surface of Monet's iconic water lilies. He's also the author of the novels Ex Libris and Domino, and in the days before the pandemic, he frequently lectured in both North America and Europe. He's here tonight with his new book, The Bookseller of Florence, the story of the manuscripts that illuminated the Renaissance. The book conjures a revelatory vision of the remarkable 15th century Florentine merchant, craftsman, and intellectual Vespasiano da Bisticci, who has been referred to as the king of the world's booksellers. I am reading the book right now, and I am particularly enjoying its vivid representation of life in Renaissance Florence, and I'm having a good time following all the protagonists of such an incredible moment in the history of Western culture. A review in the Wall Street Journal calls his work a marvel of storytelling and a masterclass in the history of the book, and a dazzling, instructive, and highly entertaining book worthy of the great booksellers it celebrates. Ross, grazie mille, and thank you so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Welcome, everyone. I was just reminiscing with Jason and Irene a few minutes ago about the first time I appeared at the Free Library in person back in those days, about 15 years ago, when the fire alarm went off midway into my talk and we all had to file out and stand in the street before we then filed back in and I continued. So let's hope nothing like that happens to any of us today. What I'm going to do is talk for about 40 minutes or so on the book, just give you a kind of intro to it. And then, as Irene said, I'll take questions after that. Usually with a book, I either have the title immediately, as with Brunelleschi's Dome, or it's something that I come up with, or someone else comes up with long after I've finished writing the book, as in the case of Mad Enchantment or Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling. But with The Bookseller of Florence, I had the title immediately, and I'll get to who the bookseller is in a couple of minutes. But I think in some ways it's a title that is estranging, or we associate Florence with frescoes and with sculpture, with art, with architecture, things like that, and not so much with books. And so what I wanted to do with this book is tell the great story of the bookish people in Florence, because I think their story is as vital and as important as the artistic story of Florence. I mean, for obvious reasons, we think of Florence in terms of art. And I, as much as anyone, have been responsible for trying to promote the work of Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Brunelleschi, and so forth, and these other books. But what I wanted to do with The Bookseller of Florence was to celebrate and tell the story of this other cast of characters who existed alongside them and really worked in tandem with them on a kind of political and cultural vision. They were a kind of cast of scribes, scholars, notaries, librarians, priests, monks, sort of bookworms and ink-stained wretches who blew the dust off 1,000 years of history and tried to imagine and recreate the world of the past. They tried to go back in time and recover the works of the ancient Greeks and ancient Romans. And one of the quotes, it doesn't come from a Florentine, alas, it comes from the great humanist scholar, Desiderius Erasmus of Rotterdam, in which he talks about what it's like to be a scholar, what it was like to be a scholar back then. And he talks about, here you are fettered to the treadmill. You cannot budge an inch from your texts. You waste your eyesight on decaying volumes, covered with mold, torn and mangled, eaten into everywhere by worms and beetles, and often almost illegible. And he talks about the way, you know, you end up living in poverty, and you ruin your eyesight, you ruin your neck and your back. And yet it was out of these often quite humble labors and very arduous, difficult, time-consuming labors that I would argue that the world was created anew. And in fact, the modern world began to come into being. And so it wasn't just, one thing I would want you to take away is that it wasn't just the artists who were inventing a new world. It was these writers as well. And just to emphasize the importance of them and what the Florentines celebrated them, there's a great quote from the middle of the century, 1457, from Giovanni Rucellai, who, if you've been to Florence, you probably know that name. You've probably seen his palazzo, a very famous palazzo in Florence. And you've also probably seen his name on the facade of the Dominican Basilica of Santa Maria Novella by the train station on the west side of the city. Rucellai was a very wealthy businessman, but he was also a great appreciator of art and culture. And in 1457, when he sat down to write a kind of praise of Florence, the first thing he singled out were its scholars. This is long before he begins talking about painters and architects. He says there are more outstanding scholars of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew in Florence than ever before. And I would just add to that, more scholars of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew in Florence than anywhere else at this time, anywhere else in Europe. He says an elegant and pure Latin eloquence, the likes of which has not flourished since Cicero's time. In other words, since the time of the late Roman Republic in the first century BC, has finally returned to refine our literature. Our men of letters have revived the elegance of the ancient style that has long been lost and forgotten. So just as Filippo Brunelleschi, through his architecture, and Donatello, through his sculpture, as the pair of them were reinventing the world, reinventing visual space by doing creative imitations of ancient models, so too these writers and scholars and notaries and teachers and librarians and booksellers were doing the same thing through literature. And in fact, they were doing it before. And I think I would argue that Brunelleschi and Donatello were absorbing these ideas from what we now call the humanist scholars in Florence, absorbing these ideas and making it work in three-dimensional form. So there's this close link between them. And so I'd wanted for years to tell the story of them, the story of Athens on the Arno, as it came to be called, because of the lovers of wisdom, the philosophers that lived there. And the trick, though, was to find someone who could unite everything, someone that I could use to tell the story in the way that I obviously had Filippo Brunelleschi to tell the story of the dome. But how to tell this sort of multifaceted tale of the recovery of ancient knowledge and its diffusion around, first of all, around Italy, but ultimately around Europe. And the answer came to me, I don't know how many years ago now, when I began, I kept coming across a certain name, and that name was Vespasiano da Bisticci. And he was often referred to as the favorite bookseller of Cosimo de' Medici. This epithet was always attached to his name. And you will come across his name if you read perhaps Christopher Hibbert's very good books on the Medici or his biography of Florence. Hibbert makes full use of Vespasiano's writings on Cosimo. And I think he's the one who first described him as Cosimo's favorite bookseller. And so I thought, well, what does that mean? What is it to be the bookseller to Cosimo de' Medici? And what does it mean to be buying a book at that time? And what was the book culture and book selling culture like in Florence at that time or in Europe at that time? So I began looking into Vespasiano, who fortunately wrote a lot. And he didn't only sell books, but he wrote books. And so I was able to look at them and begin exploring his life. And I realized there's a much, much bigger story there than him simply being Cosimo de' Medici's favorite bookseller, because he became known as the king of the world's booksellers. And he truly was the greatest merchant of knowledge in the 15th century, and one of the greatest of all time, you could argue, one of the greatest before the 19th or 20th century, before the modern era, because of the fact that he created thousands, perhaps many thousands of manuscripts of, for example, the Greek and Latin classics, which, as I say, were being rediscovered at that time, often by Florentines, but certainly brought to Florence. And Vespasiano was the conduit through which these began going out into the rest of the world. And so I started writing about him, researching him, writing about him. And it really did open a really exciting world to me. I'll just introduce him a little bit, because he's not a name that we conjure with, because of the fact that I write about very famous people for the most part, Claude Monet, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, etc. But here, this is someone who's much more obscure. And he was obscure in birth. He was born, as far as we know, in 1422. His birth record, the record of his birth, has never been found. And so I had to reconstruct it through his tax declarations later in life, where he says how old he was. And if you do the maths on a few of them, you realize he was born late, most likely born late 1422. I mean, he died in 1498, a ripe old age for the 15th century. And the key thing then is that he spans what he himself called the golden age of Florence. He becomes active in the 1430s and really worked for the rest of his life. And so what we have is, through his life, by telling his story, I could tell, give a kind of panorama of Florence at that particular time and all of the other actors with whom, as we'll see, he was interacting. So born just outside of Florence in 1422, his father, who was named Filippo, was a wool merchant, probably sort of a middle class, relatively successful wool merchant who actually did some business with the Medici, who had their fingers in the wool trade as well as the banking trade. But sadly, Pippo died in 1426 when Vespasiano was four, and when Vespasiano's mother was pregnant with the sixth child. And so his mother, Mona Matea, was left with, in 1426, with six children, six mouths to feed. They were downwardly mobile at that point. And the family went into a decline. And in fact, we can track Vespasiano's early years because of the fact that his mother moves to increasingly inexpensive lodgings. And finally, in 1433, when Vespasiano is 11, he goes off to, in fact, he's just turned 11, when early in 1434, he goes off to work. One of the things about Renaissance Florence that we have to face is that they had child labor, as most places in Europe did at that point. But Vespasiano, very interestingly, went not into the wool trade, as we might expect, not into the goldsmithing trade, as one of his older brothers did. He went to work for a bookseller. And it's a bit of a mystery how this happened. It's unclear if, A, he had a choice in the matter and said, I like books, I want to go to work for a bookseller, or whether he was maybe talent spotted by his schoolmaster, and he only would have had 5 or 6 years of schooling at this point, talent spotted by his schoolmaster, who then found a job for him or whether it was just entirely random. What it is hard to, and probably never be known, because he himself does not explain the way in which this happened. But an interesting thing about him is his forename, Vespasiano, is a very atypical name. I've only been able to find from the tax records in Florence one other Vespasiano in Florence at that time. And, you know, it's an imperial name. He was named after the Emperor Vespasian, whereas all of his other, all of his siblings have very common names like Jacopo and Leonardo, etc. And yet he is Vespasiano. And so it's almost as if greatness was going to be conferred on him in some particular way, or great things were expected of him. So what then happens? At the age of 11, he goes to work in the street of booksellers. For those of you who've been to Florence, and for those of us who are homesick for it because we haven't been able to go back because of the pandemic, I show us this aerial view of it, and we're looking north over the city from just sort of above the Arno, just north of the Arno. We have the dome and the baptistry here. This is the civic part. So the ecclesiastical part of Florence here and the civic part with the town hall, the Palazzo Vecchio, with the enormous piazza in front of it. The street of booksellers is sort of midway between the two of them. And many of you, if you've been to Florence, will have walked in the street of booksellers, the Via dei Librai, as it was then known. It's now the Via del Proconsolo, but you might know it because of the fact that you were going to the Bargello, the great sculpture museum, which has the Michelangelo room on the ground floor and the Donatello room, a floor above that. But the street of booksellers literally ran those couple of blocks past the Bargello. And that's where he went to work. He started at the age of 11. I'll just zoom in a little bit, and you can see the way it's situated. It's between the twin towers, the Tower of the Badia and the Tower of the Bargello. And the bookshop was owned by someone named Michele Guarducci, who was primarily a bookbinder, but he did sell books as well. But he had this little corner shop, which was right beside the Bargello, what's now the Bargello, what was then the office of the chief magistrate, and directly across from the Badia, whose steps we see here, the Benedictine Abbey. And the shop still exists. It now sells pizzas rather than books and manuscripts. It's a pizzeria. But this is where Vespasiano went to work. And it was, in some ways, he was the right person at the right time, because this was a famous spot in Florence, possibly because of the fact that the Badia had a very good library, possibly because of the fact that this is a sort of slightly open space in this narrow street. And mostly because of the fact that it was lined with bookshops. It's called the Street of Booksellers, obviously, because this is where the booksellers, or the cartelai, as they were called, had their shops. And so people would come to buy books in this street, and conversations naturally grew up. And outside of this, alfresco conversations, and outside this Guarducci's bookshop was one of the famous meeting places in Florence, where you would get all the intellectuals of the day gathering. In the Florentine dialect, this was referred to as sul canto del palaggio, or next to, beside the Palazzo del Podestà, as it was known back then. And so Vespasiano, I think, quite literally began learning things in the street. His education was a street education, as he listened to the debates between and among these intellectual luminaries who were in Florence at this time and have enormous reputations. And what clearly happens is that a couple of them take him under their wing. They clearly recognize, I think, the two things that we can say for certain about Vespasiano. One is that he was a quick study. He was very brilliant. In fact, I was thinking I should have thought of a publicity campaign for the book or something, where I called him the Michelangelo of manuscripts or something like that. But he certainly was the master of it. He was a very quick study, and he was intellectually curious. And this was recognized by by these intellectuals who are obviously at this time much older than him. But the other thing is he was clearly very charming. Everyone seemed to like him, and he could ingratiate himself to people from the highest level of society, as we'll see. So he begins getting his education here on the street outside, and also, of course, inside the bookshop as well, because Guarducci must have been training him up, recognizing his talents. And possibly we should give Michele Guarducci credit for why Vespasiano ends up in his shop. So just a couple of points about what exactly a bookseller did in those days. Technically, they were just called cartolai, or the singular cartolaio. But they sold, which is a reference to the fact that they sold paper, but they sold much more than paper. And they also sold much more than books or manuscript bound pages, or you could buy them loose. They sold new and used manuscripts. They bound books, which was a big part of the trade. They sold paper. You could buy ink and pens, things like that. So it's sort of like a Hudson News or something like that. But they were also publishers, because if you were a writer, a philosopher, a poet, someone like that, you could go to a cartolaio with your sheaf of papers on which you'd scribbled and say, I want you to create 3 copies of this for me. And they would hire the scribe, they would hire the illuminator if you wanted that. And they would then disseminate the 3 in the way that you wanted, either selling them from the shop or making presentation copies. But what's interesting then about the bookshop, which Vespasiano begins to take over, by the time he's in his 20s, he becomes the guiding force behind the bookshop in the street of booksellers. And it transforms itself into something much more than just a place where books are bought and sold. It becomes a reading room. I mean, we have eyewitness accounts of people talking about how they've come into the bookshop and seen people sitting down. You know, the latest book has arrived from Rome or Naples, and people are sitting down reading it together or separately, and then they'll discuss it, and it becomes a debating society. A lot of intellectuals, some of whom we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, would meet there, and there'd be debates. And one eyewitness talks about how he would, see in Vespasiano's shop some of the, bishops debating philosophers in the shop of R. Vespasiano, surrounded by groups of people. So it became a kind of place, well, like the free library, a place to hear talks and to have intellectual discussion. But sometimes, the discussion wasn't always that intellectual, because it was also where you could go to get gossip and information. And Vespasiano was probably the most well-connected and well-informed person in Florence, because everyone came into his shop. And often when dignitaries came from other cities and wanted to meet people, the first place they would go would be to Vespasiano's shop. Because he knew everyone and he could effect the necessary introductions for them. And so you get these people with enormous reputations. A poet, for example, from Hungary, the greatest, probably the next to Matthias Corvinus, the greatest Hungarian of the 15th century, Janus Pannonius. The first thing he did when he came to Florence was went to Vespasiano's shop and said, introduce me to everyone. But ultimately then this serves Vespasiano as a political way, because he becomes a spy. I won't have much chance to talk about that, but obviously someone who's that well informed and who has his finger on the pulse of all of these things that are happening in Florence and outside of Florence is going to be very useful as a conduit of information. And so he traded not just in books and manuscripts, but also in information. One of the first things he would have learned was binding books. And this is an image from about a century or so later. And we can see that if you're 11 or 12, this is hard physical work, but this is where he would have been put to work in the back room, which was very much like a craftsman shop. He would have been stitching leaves of parchment together, planing boards down so that they could the books could be put between the boards and covering the boards with leather or velvet, things like that. So it's very much a craftsman's workshop, as well as where you would hear hammers and saws and things like that in operation, as well as being this sort of refined intellectual atmosphere in the next room. One of the first things he would do, and he obviously worked from the ground up. I should just say that the period I'm talking about right now, the 1430s and 40s, is obviously before the printing press. And so when I talk about books at this period, I'm obviously talking about handwritten manuscripts. And this is the trade that Vespasiano was learning. And so the first thing he would do would be to get his parchment. He would go to a parchmenter who would have gone to a butcher shop a week or two earlier and bought some hides and then put them in a vat of a lye mixture and had the hair and flesh removed and scraped them down to 1/250th of an inch, and then it would be cut so that the scribe could work on it. And I thought I'd just read you a brief passage just for a couple of minutes about the sort of beginnings of the creation of a work like this and what Vespasiano would have been learning at this time as a youngster. The word manuscript comes from the Latin manuscriptus, written by hand, but any manuscript was the product of much more work than simply the writing of a single hand. It was a months or even years long multi-step process calling for the expertise of a series of tradesmen and specialist craftsmen, from parchment makers to scribes, miniaturists, gold beaters, and even apothecaries, carpenters, and blacksmiths. Vespasiano occasionally produced works on paper, of which, like all Cartolae, he carried ready supplies. For the most part, though, his clients expected him to use parchment. Cartolae carried stalks of parchment, which was made from the skin of sheep or goats, and also sometimes from donkeys. The most beautiful and expensive material on which to write was calfskin or vellum, the word vellum coming, like the word veal, from vitulus, Latin for calf. The younger the calf, the finer and whiter the skin. Uterine vellum from aborted or stillborn calves was the finest and whitest of all, but also infrequently used. The supply of hides for parchment was always dependent on the dietary preferences of the local population. The appetite in Italy for goats, one recipe book offered advice on how to spit roast, boil or stew them, how to cook their eyes, ears, lungs and testicles, and how to make pies from their heads, meant that manuscripts in Italy were often made from goatskin. This reliance of the book industry on the palate of the locals is reflected in the lament by a 13th century patriarch of Cyprus, Gregory II, that not until after Lent, when people began eating meat again, would he be able to get the hides required for a manuscript of Demosthenes. For hundreds of years, the transmission of knowledge had depended on the carnivorous appetites and good animal husbandry. Large volumes with hundreds of pages required the skins of many animals. One goat was often needed for each page of parchment in a large liturgical book, such as an antiphonary, while a Bible might take the skins of more than 200 animals, an entire herd of goats or flock of sheep. So it was not for the faint-hearted, the making of books. And of course, then once Vespasiano gets his parchment and has it prepared, the first thing that he has to do is to hire a scribe. And this scribe, this image that I'm showing you, is someone who is, I think from this row, probably a Franciscan, in other words, a friar. And when we think of scribes in the Middle Ages, we think of monks and friars copying out manuscripts. And certainly that was true in the Middle Ages, but really by the 1300s, and then more especially in the 1400s, Vespasiano's time, what we get are professional scribes, people who have trained as notaries and who are not in holy orders, but know Latin and have good handwriting, who become the scribes. And in fact, for the most part, that's the profile of the kind of people that Vespasiano used. He had a stable of 40 or 50 people at any given time that he could tap and say, copy me this manuscript? I need it a month from now. And can you copy it out for me? And so I did some research into some of the scribes. One of the, my favorite was a hermit, literally a hermit who lived, some of you might know Fiesole, north of Florence. He lived in the hills outside of Fiesole, literally in a cave. And Vespasiano would go to his cave with the parchment and give it to him, and he would copy it out. Vespasiano would go back to the cave and pick it up. One of his other ones worked in, while he was in prison. In his colophon, he writes that he's writing this in jail. They often put, the scribes often put little notes at the end of the book about their own personal circumstances, or sometimes just saying, thank God I'm finished writing this incredibly tedious book. So there are often places where they let their hair down a bit and also tell us something about them. But this is what a page of one of the books that he produced looked like. This one was done in the mid-1440s for an English divine who had come to, spent many years in Italy before ultimately going back to England and becoming Bishop of Ely. But he left his manuscripts that Vespasiano made to him to his old college at Oxford, Balliol College, which still has them. We can see that it's extremely beautiful. Before I get to the illustration, oh, by the way, you saw what, despite Vespasiano's facility with Latin, because ultimately he learned Latin, I think it's safe to say he never learned English, because he referred to William Gray as Guglielmo Grame in all of his writings. And this is his scribe, Gerardo del Ciriaggio, has done this for him. He was one of Vespasiano's favorite scribes. And I think we can understand why writes extremely beautifully and extremely clearly. I don't have time to talk about it, but one of the things I look at in the book is the way in which we owe the Florentines the fact that we have not had for the past 500 years eye strain and bad tempers and blindness and frustration when we read, because the Florentines affected a change in, they reinvented the book essentially, and Vespasiano was clearly a big part of this, but they changed handwriting. They did not like the Gothic script that had developed in France, in northern France, in the 1100s, and they wanted a much easier, more legible style of writing. In the 1300s, they were constantly complaining about this style of writing. And finally, the reform was effected in the early 1400s, and all of Vespasiano's scribes use this beautiful, very clear writing. And I think I'm putting it beneath in our letters, and I think you can see just how, once you learn a couple of tricks, like the S's look like F's, you can make out every letter in this, which is very, very difficult to do in the case of Gothic. And so this is a big part. And when I talk about the printing press, which I don't have time to talk about tonight, when I talk about the printing press, this is what it's called Roman type, but it could be called Florentine type because it was really invented there. But that's the Roman printers begin using this style of writing for their type. And of course, he had the manuscripts illustrated, very beautifully illustrated. With gold leaf, which was always, after the scribe wrote, the scribe would leave a space and often write a cue, a small cue in, which was then and the pages would be given to the illuminator, who would then go to work and realize, okay, I have to put a cue here and begin his design, first of all, or her design, because women worked as scribes and illuminators also, usually nuns. And so, he or she would have gone to a gold beater and acquired the gold leaf, and which is beaten down to 1/300,000th of an inch, applied to gesso or mixture of gesso, a kind of clay, and sometimes honey to attach it. And then it would be polished with a dog's tooth, literally a canine tooth on a stick, and just polished it so it lay completely flat. And then the painting began. Gold wasn't even the most expensive material used. Ultramarine blue is much more expensive. It was ultramarine, or ultramare, means beyond the sea. And it did come from beyond the sea. It was made from lapis lazuli, the stone which is found in the Hindu Kush mountains of Afghanistan. And so it was very far away, but it's also very beautiful. That was the only source of it at that time. And it was very expensive. Only the elite obviously could afford to have something like this done. Almost as expensive as saffron, with the little yellow dots that we can see on here. It came from crocuses, and it took the stigmas of 4,000 crocuses to make an ounce of saffron pigment. So it was hideously expensive likewise. And so obviously Vespasiano making these beautiful manuscripts is catering for a clientele who can afford them, because they cost a book like this. I don't have records on what William Gray paid for these, but it probably would have cost around 50 ducats. And to put, or florins, the florin and the ducat being of equivalent value, 50 ducats was roughly what a good tradesman could earn in the course of a year. And in fact, most scribes probably earned 50 or 60 ducats per year. So a scribe could not afford, or cost a scribe his or her year's salary in order to buy back what he or she had done. And it's sort of classic Marx's alienation of labor. But these are the guys that he's working with, working for. Three generations of the Medici, Cosimo, his sons Piero and Giovanni, and both of whom died quite young. And then, of course, Piero's son, Lorenzo the Magnificent. He worked for Nicholas V, Tommaso Parentuccelli, who was a great scholar, who was elected Pope Nicholas V, and became the first Renaissance Pope, as he's usually called. And crucially, these people, Cosimo and Nicholas V in particular, became very close friends of his, and he wrote biographies of them. But he was also very good friends with three generations of the kings of Naples, Alfonso, especially with Ferdinand then, and Ferdinand's son, Alfonso. In fact, he worked as a spy for Ferdinand and passed on political information to him. He worked for most of the lords and dukes around Italy, all of whom wanted to burnish the reputations for magnificence and cultural refinement by building magnificent libraries. And so they obviously came to him for it, and he catered to their whims and tastes and things like that. He had an international clientele in England with the Duke of Worcester, as well as William Gray and a few other people. Cardinal Bessarion, who has loaned his hand and his book to the cover of the Bookseller of Florence. One of the interesting things that happens in the course of Vespasiano's career is a lot of these guys earn their money or earn their keep, such as Duke Alfonso, Borso d'Este, Alessandro Sforza, by being soldiers of fortune, by being mercenary captains. And so what was bound to happen, and what did happen repeatedly, is Vespasiano's clients would go to war with one another. And that, one of my favorite moments, is in summer 1467, they went to war. There was a war between Florence and, or the Florentines and a sort of group of Florentine exiles who tried to come back into the city. So all these warlords scrambled to take sides, and four of Vespasiano's clients, including Alfonso, Borso, and Alessandro, rode into battle against each other, with Alfonso against these two. Alfonso was assisted, though, by in that enterprise by Vespasiano's greatest client and the greatest soldier of the age, and the greatest collector of the age, Federigo da Montefeltro, the Duke of Urbino, who put together what Vespasiano said was the finest library since antiquity. And I like this portrait of him showing him reading one of Vespasiano's books, because Vespasiano tells us that he personally bound Federigo's books in scarlet velvet, and also attached beautiful bosses to it. And whatever book this is that he's reading is probably, as we speak, in the Vatican Library, which is where ultimately the books from the library in Urbino went after Federigo's death, or a couple of decades after his death. But you can see that he's a reader as well as a soldier. He's got his helmet at the ready for when he inevitably goes into battle. And he was a very learned man. He had five people at his court whose sole job was to read to him in his moments of leisure, including on the battlefield or in his tent when he was marching on his way to battle. And it was for him that Vespasiano created his greatest work, which was the Urbino Bible, which now is in the Vatican, like so many of those other ones. It's a two-volume Bible made in the 1470s, 1476, to wait. It took 2 years to complete. And if you think Manuscript Illumination is a minor art, look at the names. The Ghirlandaio Workshop has been busy on it. The great Domenico himself, who 2 years after he finishes this, goes to Rome and works on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. And he's got his two brothers with him, working on it. And of course, Ghirlandaio, 10 years after working on the Urbino Bible, will have a young kid come into his workshop in Florence named Michelangelo Buonarroti. The greatest artist, Fra Angelico, Lorenzo Monaco, people with colossal reputations in other fields, also other fields of painting, other media also worked in manuscript illustration. And with Federigo, just to conclude, one of my favorite moments happens with one of Vespasiano's manuscripts. He just finished. If you look at the date on the Urbino Bible, he finishes it with exquisitely bad timing in the spring of 1478, and he's ready to send it to Urbino. But what happens in April of 1478 is we have the Pazzi conspiracy, this attempt on the part of Pope Sixtus IV to have the Medicis removed from power in Florence. Ultimately, the mercenaries take it upon themselves to try to murder them. And they do kill Lorenzo the Magnificent's younger brother, Giuliano, who we see being killed in this 19th century imagining of it. But what then happened is Vespasiano had this two-volume Bible that Federigo was eager to get, but it could not be sent because of war. Federigo da Montefeltro was on the side of the Pope. He was now one of his daughters was married to one of the Pope's nephews. Federigo sided with the Pope against Lorenzo. So Vespasiano had to use all of his emollients, all of his diplomatic skills to get the Bible delivered. And that's what he did during war. The Pazzi War was on between Lorenzo and Federigo da Montefeltro. And Federigo approached Vespasiano and told him, can you arrange for the Bible? Can you talk to Lorenzo? And that's what Vespasiano did. And Federigo then wrote a letter saying, Vespasiano promptly and with goodwill offered every help and favor in sending the Bible which I had made in Florence, for which I thank your magnificence. And when my editor read that passage, he said to me, this is like the Christmas truce in the trenches in 1914, that battle stops or hostilities cease long enough for this beautiful Bible to be delivered from Florence to Urbino. One of the things that Vespasiano said is the printed volume would be a shame to be among his books. But of course, what happened, just to conclude, is that the printing press was invented when he was at the height of his powers. Because of course, in 1454, Gutenberg created his Bible, the Gutenberg Bible, the 42-line Bible. So the question is, what does Vespasiano do? What will become of him and his shop with the advent of the printed book? And so the last part of the book, maybe the last third of the book, is looking at the arrival of printed books in Italy and Vespasiano's response to it. Ultimately, without giving too much away, Vespasiano becomes a writer. He retreats, he leaves Florence and goes to his little place, a two-hour walk outside of Florence, his family home, his patrimony, and he begins writing books. And that's one of the great legacies that he's left to us is his Lives of Illustrious Men of the 15th century, where he writes about Federigo da Montefeltro, Cosimo de' Medici, Alfonso the Magnanimous, all of these people that he knew and who were his clients, and leaves us really unforgettable and also extremely valuable records of what these people were like and also what his life was like. And so it was a very good resource for me to go back in that, to time travel back into that period and try to excavate his life and tell his story and that larger story of which he was such an important part. And I'll say that I've merely scratched the surface of Vespasiano's life and what went on. But I have, in a shameless bit of self-promotion, besides the book, you might want to check out my YouTube channel, Renaissance Discoveries, in which I talk about various things that are tangentially related to the book in some ways, that sort of flesh out things that appear in the book and some things that ended up on the cutting room floor because we didn't have room. In any case, thanks so much for your patience. And I hope some of you have questions for me so that we can continue the discussion for a little bit.
Thank you so much for that. That was incredible. And also, we are going to link to your YouTube page when we post this video. So
I'm very much a novice at this. This is me as a filmmaker. So it's been a steep but fun learning curve doing it.
No, I'm sure it's terrific. I can't wait to check it out. So I'm going to try to get to as many of the questions as possible. So let's dive right in. This question comes from Sharon. How were ancient Greek and Roman books discovered by the Florentines? Where were those books? Yeah. In what shape? Great question.
Fantastic question. And it's a great, great story. Most of them turned up in a place that which was maybe counterintuitive, but for us today, at least, the legacy of the ancient Greeks and especially the ancient Romans was not found in sunny Italy. It was found in the north of England, or it was preserved in the north of England, and then went from there, and Ireland, and went from there to the Low Countries, to France, and to Germany. I spend probably half a chapter on this sort of recovery and the manuscript hunters who realized there wasn't much left to find in Italy. And they, because of the Lombard invasions, primarily of, in the 600s and 700s AD, there wasn't much left. And chroniclers of the time write how all the learned people and their manuscripts left Italy at that point. We're hoping to find a work of Quintilian, for example, and I discuss him in the book, this great Roman teacher on rhetoric. Your best bet was to go north of the Alps into German monasteries, French monasteries, Swiss monasteries, places like that, where there would be a manuscript probably copied in the time of Charlemagne or in the next century after. In other words, in the 9th century, maybe the 10th century. And it would have been converted from maybe a 4th, 5th, 6th century copy done perhaps by an Anglo-Saxon scribe or an Irish scribe, which it then brought over to the Low Countries or France and then recopied. And one of the things that the book is about is the slender thread by which so much knowledge hung for so many centuries. And the Greek is a whole other story. And I do talk a lot about Plato, because a big part of the book is the rediscovery of Plato, which was, you could argue, one of the greatest contributions of the 15th century. And it was Plato was rediscovered in Florence in the 1400s. Before 1400, right up until the year 1400, of Plato's 36 dialogues, only four had been translated. Only four were known in the West, and they've been translated very badly, and they were also incomplete. And yet, through the course of the decades, the Florentines recovered. They got the manuscripts and ultimately translated them into Latin, making them available across Europe. Anyway, it's a wonderful story. It's just goose flesh raising story about how they went through all of this. So once again, I do discuss it in the book and also in the Plato video on my YouTube channel.
Is there a concentration of booksellers now in Florence? Has that tradition been carried on? Is there that?
I wish I could say that the street of booksellers still had booksellers or still had a kind of agglomeration of them, but it isn't the case. There were booksellers not far from that and beautiful stationery stores that sell the beautiful paper from Fabriano and places like that. But there isn't that I'm aware of a kind of dense cluster of shops like that. And that might be a factor of the high rent in the center of Florence, that, you know, booksellers, as Vespasiano said, people who deal in books are often poor in possessions. And so it's the sort of lifelong story or centuries long story of, right. of booksellers and publishers and writers.
Well, no, these days they make just tons of money, right? So I think this question, Brian asks, what distinguished one bookstore from the other? So I guess what distinguished one of these people? Did they specialize in different things?
Sure. To some extent, yes, a specialization in different things. But I suppose you would look for the quality of the parchment. Ultimately, what distinguished, so if you look at, say, I think in the 1430s, there were 8 shops in the street of booksellers. Later, there'd be about a dozen by the 1470s. And so you had to pick, you could pick and choose from a lot. So you'd look at the quality of the materials they used, and Vespasiano probably had the best and the best scribes working for him. His books were obviously the most important. But what set him apart and how he made his reputation was, and I give the sentence, which is a shocking sentence to read about someone who's 24 and who left school at 11. But in Arezzo, south of Florence in 1446, when he was 24, there was a bishop, an abbot, who wants to get a copy of Pliny the Elder's Natural History, a very popular work from the ancient world. Pliny the Elder was the guy who died when Vesuvius blew up. He went partly because of curiosity, sailed across the Bay of Naples to see what was happening, but also to effect a rescue mission. He was a naval commander and died on the beach because of the explosion at Vesuvius. But his work was incredibly popular, and there were hundreds of manuscripts. And if you wanted a copy of Pliny, you had to get the best of the 200 odd copies that you knew were out there. And Vespasiano is the one who could do that, because what the abbot said when he wanted this copy of Pliny is, he said, "Our Vespasiano is the best guide for this." In other words, to get the best copy of Pliny, or really anyone else, Vespasiano had the scholarly acumen to recognize that manuscript A is better than manuscript B, but manuscript F is the best of all. And so he would get manuscript F, which meant he had access. He somehow got access to a lot of private collections to see their manuscripts, and then was allowed to borrow them. And so that was really what set him apart. And that's how he made his reputation, with that sort of quality control. So his books weren't just beautiful, and they certainly were beautiful, but they were also the sort of definitive editions of the manuscripts that came out. And people often wrote on them. If they got the book from Vespasiano, they would write on it that it came from his bookshop. And that was obviously a kind of mark of quality and quality control.
Flo asks, were any women part of these intellectual circles?
They could not gather in the street or in the piazzas as the men did, because women were forbidden to do that. In fact, some of the preachers said women shouldn't even stand in their own doorway, and they shouldn't appear at the windows. And they had to be chaperoned when they went out of doors. A young woman had to be chaperoned by someone who was older. And even in church, they were separated from the men. The Cathedral of Florence in 1476 bought a new curtain, which was drawn across the nave to separate the men from the women, visually as well as physically. And so women, yes, whatever the 15th century in Florence might have been, it was not a particularly good time to be a woman. Women from high society were educated. There were certainly educated women at this time, probably most famously and most notably the mother of Lorenzo the Magnificent, Lucrezia Tornabuoni, who came from a family allied to the Medici. They were a banker, is very wealthy, and she wrote poetry. She knew Latin and also Greek. And also Federico de Montefeltro, we're going outside of Florence here, but Battista Sforza was her name. She knew Latin, Greek, and delivered orations. And as a young woman who had seven daughters, who gave birth to seven daughters in a row until she finally gave birth to a son, and then died giving birth to him, the heir that you saw in that image of Federico, the little boy. She ran the state on his behalf. When he was away soldiering, she controlled Urbino. So there were certainly strong, brilliant women, but the Florentines didn't exactly give them a chance to shine. I do discuss women in the book because of what I haven't talked about tonight, but what I think is a great story is the printing press. The first successful printing press in Florence starts up in 1476, which is 20 years after Gutenberg, and it is at the Dominican convent of San Jacopo di Ripoli, which is a convent of nuns. The printing press business was run by a man, a friar, but he used the women as compositors because San Jacopo di Ripoli had a great tradition of creating manuscripts. And so clearly Fra Domenico, the friar who ran the printing press, decided that what he was going to do would be to get these women who were literate, who also well-versed in Latin, because they'd been copying out manuscripts, some of them for decades, he would get them to be the type compositors. And so they put together many of the books, including the sort of magnum opus of the Ripoli Press, which was the first Latin edition of the complete works of Plato. So I haven't talked about the nuns and San Jacopo di Ripoli this evening, but that is a big part of the book and the way in which print comes to Florence, and what sort of changes it begins affecting.
The next question, briefly, from Eugene, is, this is so interesting, will the recording be made available later? To all the folks at home, you can go to youtube.com/author events or go to our library page, which I'm sure you saw to get here. So I think we got time for one or two more questions. There was a question about what you spoke a little bit of you know, where his books ended up at the Vatican here and there. But the question is, what of his legacy remains? And I think that pertains both to his books and to family. And these families tend to be very old and stay in these Renaissance cities. Does he still have family around?
Also? I've never encountered any descendants. And his family were not exactly fruitful and multiplying. He never married. And one of his brothers just married at the age of 60. He did have a nephew, but his nephew died very young before having any children. And so as far as I could tell, the line died out probably quite soon after he died in 1498, probably within a century. I've never come across people who were related, you know, who descended from the family. But his legacy in the Florentines celebrate him to some extent. He is buried in the Church of Santa Croce, the great Franciscan Basilica on the east side of the city, which is the pantheon of the Florentine greats, because that's where Michelangelo is buried, that's where Galileo is buried, Machiavelli is buried. They've got the cenotaph, the tomb that's awaiting Dante if Ravenna ever decides that they're going to release the bones of Dante and allow the Florentines to welcome him back from exile 700 years later. And Vespasiano was there, but he's in his brother's grave. His brother was likewise, his oldest brother, was very successful as a doctor and was doctor to many of the same people who Vespasiano was the bookseller to. And his brother made more money as a doctor than Vespasiano did as a bookseller. And so his brother had this sort of grave tomb. And Vespasiano, after he died some 20 years after his brother, was just lowered into that tomb. But there was a little plaque on the wall that they put in 1898 on the, I guess it would have been the 400th anniversary of his death. They put up a plaque for him on the wall.
Well, at least some things haven't changed, that, you know, doctors are making way more than booksellers. So I think we have time for one more question. And if something I was kind of wondering, and Ryan asked this question too, And I'll only add a little bit onto the end of it. He says, it must be difficult to bring a relatively obscure person to life in print in a compelling way. And he lists a few of your other subjects. He says, how do you overcome this challenge? And I guess I would add on to that, what specifically, again, you're known for a few of these larger looming figures, and not that you know, tonight's subject isn't significant, but can you talk about the challenges in that and what specifically drew you to him?
Sure. The challenges in it are much the same, actually, as the in some ways the challenges you face with Leonardo da Vinci, in that there are gaps in our knowledge about him. And obviously, Leonardo and Michelangelo have much more written about them, and you get a sense of the interior life of Michelangelo because of some of his letters and especially because of his poetry. But Leonardo da Vinci is very, you know, he was a mysterious, elusive figure. And so in some ways it was difficult to bring him to life because we don't really have a lot of his interior imagination. We have a body of work and we have his aspirations and things like that. And Vespasiano in some ways was the same. He was, you know, difficult to track in some ways, month by month, unlike Claude Monet, for example. Monet was the easiest in that respect because I could almost go week by week in the course of those years, 1912 to 26, that I wrote about, knowing what he was doing and also what was happening in France or what was happening with his family at that time. But obviously, the farther you go back in history, the more shallow and difficult to excavate the historical record becomes. But I think in terms of the challenge about bringing to life someone who history has forgotten, and I do talk about why he was forgotten in the book, I think there's something exciting about that when you find someone who is important, who has been overlooked. And I guess an equivalent thing that I did was with, in my book, Judgment of Paris, which is about art in France at the beginning of the Impressionist period in the 1860s and 70s, where I wrote about a very famous painter in his own time named Ernest Meissonier, who was an opponent of Manet and the Impressionists. And yet no one had ever heard of him since his death in 1891, his reputation collapsed. And in some ways, and so it was fun bringing Meissonier back into public consciousness, such as I was able to. And so I think I'm trying to do much the same with Vespasiano and show that there is another side to the Renaissance. When we think Renaissance, if we think Renaissance as tourists, we think Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Brunelleschi, and things like this. But I want to tell that other, and as I said in my opening remarks, related side to it, which is this beautiful efflorescence of culture and learning where Florence became the cultural leader of Europe for many decades, leaving behind the Parisians, leaving behind Rome, all of that. And it's such an exciting thing to happen in a city where artistically things are taking off as well.
Well, there are many more questions in the bin, and I'm sure most of them are answered in the book. And also, I have to point out that you are in England, so it is in the very small hours of the morning now. So we really appreciate it. We will link also, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, to Ross's YouTube, which is Renaissance Discoveries, correct?
That's right,
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
For anyone who has an urgent question, I haven't looked at them, so I'm not sure what they are, but if you're really curious about something, you can reach me via my website, also rosskingbooks.com. There's a contact page on that, so you can shoot me the question that way as well.
Well, Ross, thank you so much for being here. Thanks to our introducer, Irene Malfatto. And yeah, have a terrific night. Congratulations on the success of the book. And we'll see you for the next one, hopefully in person.
Absolutely, yes. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.